starts the collection for the tabernacle, then the Ark of the Testimony, or the Ark of the Covenant, the bread of the presence, or the showbread, the lampstand. Last week, we were in Exodus 26, the structure of the tabernacle, the holy place and the most holy place. And now in chapter 27, we are looking at the court and, or the altar, the court, and then two verses on the care of the lampstand, verses 20 and 21. Then next week, Lord willing, Matt will have us study Exodus 28, the priests and their ministry, the garments of the priesthood. If you turn ahead to Exodus 31, you have the men who would be called for the building of the tabernacle. You have a Bezaleel and a Aholiab. Then it's interesting, this section ends with a reflection on the Sabbath. And then you have the golden calf. So it is just interesting as you consider the order and the outline. And especially as we look at chapters 25 through 28, we ask the question, what is significant about the order that we have here? And I won't let Matt answer the question, but has anyone else reflected on the order of these chapters? Is there an order that's presented here? I think there is. Any ideas on why the order is the way it is? I would suggest it is the different degrees of holiness. You begin with the Ark of the Covenant, the Ark of the Testimony. And then, as it were, you move outward from there to the showbread, that's it now in the holy place. The gold lampstand is in the holy place. We move out from there to now the tent of the tabernacle and the details that we would have there. Now we're moving to the court of the tabernacle with the altar and the fencing of that. So that I believe there is clearly an order here. We could call it different degrees of holiness, the most holy place and outward. So let's look here at verses 1 through 8. Then we'll look at verses 9 through 19 and 20 and 21. First, the altar of sacrifice. You shall make an altar of acacia wood, 5 cubits long and 5 cubits wide. The altar shall be square, and its height shall be 3 cubits. You shall make its horns on its 4 corners. Its horns shall be of 1 piece with it, and you shall overlay it with bronze. Also, you shall make its pans to receive its ashes, and its shovels, and its basins, and its forks, and its fire pans. You shall make all its utensils of bronze. You shall make a grate for it, a network of bronze. And on the network, you shall make 4 bronze rings at its 4 corners. You shall put it underneath the rim of the altar beneath, that the network may be midway up the altar. And you shall make poles for the altar, poles of acacia wood, and overlay them with bronze. The poles shall be put in the rings, and the poles shall be on the 2 sides of the altar to bear it. You shall make it hollow with boards, as it was shown you on the mountain, so shall they make it. So we have the detail for this altar. First, its size. It is 7.5 feet by 7.5 feet by approximately 4.5 feet in height. Now, the total volume would be 253 cubic feet. There's a search engine that I sometimes use called Wolfram Alpha, and if you put in any number, it will give you other comparisons. You probably never thought of this, but Old Faithful in Yellowstone, the amount of water that comes out in an eruption is about twice or five times the volume of the altar, whatever that means to you. So 253 cubic feet, if you can picture that. The altar later built for the temple was much larger. In 2 Chronicles 4:1, if you want to turn there, 2 Chronicles 4 and verse 1, "Moreover, he made a bronze altar, 20 cubits was its length, 20 cubits its width, and 10 cubits its height." So you have 900 square feet of of area for sacrifice. You can understand how they could have offered thousands of sacrifices over a period of time when you have, as I say, 900 square feet for offering sacrifice. That is a massive altar, 15 feet in height. Turn back, if you would, to Exodus 20, the end of Exodus 20. There is, you could join this with chapter 21 in terms of now special instruction, or you could say maybe we just have this as a separate section on the altar. "An altar of earth you shall make for me, and you shall sacrifice on it your burnt offerings and your peace offerings, your sheep and your oxen." This is Exodus 20, starting with verse 24. "In every place where I record my name, I will come to you and I will bless you. And if you make me an altar of stone, you shall not build it of hewn stone, for if you use your tool on it, you have profaned it." That's Exodus 20, 24 and 25. How does that instruction connect now with this altar of burnt offering? Why did God give that instruction only a few chapters later? You have the specification for this bronze altar. Alan Cole says, perhaps the instruction in Exodus 20 is for what's called local use only. Some altar that would be built apart from the bronze altar connected with the tabernacle. Others have suggested that maybe inside this altar it was filled with earth or uncut stone. I think that's less likely. I think we have to distinguish between the altar used at the tabernacle from sacrifices that were lawfully offered to the Lord in worship someplace else. And I did a quick search on this. I don't think there are too many cases where sacrifices were offered except at the tabernacle. I found at least two lawful examples. In 1 Samuel 16, the Lord told Samuel to go to the family of Jesse for a sacrifice. And I think they're not bringing the altar with them, obviously, there. So that would be one case. 1 Kings 18, you have Elijah and the prophets of Baal. And Elijah builds an altar according to the specifications of Exodus 20. So those are two cases. Otherwise, really, the only sacrifices that were to be offered were to be offered at the tabernacle. So going back to Exodus 20, we have the size. The altar is made from acacia wood. That's the building material we have seen throughout. Matt, I don't know if you, did you look up the acacia tree?
I did, yes.
From at least a little bit, it doesn't seem like it was a large tree,
no,
right?
Not in that region. Not in
the, yeah.
I think further north, when you get up further north, they sometimes can grow acacia trees, but they're larger.
Okay.
But yeah, no, it's a small tree.
Yeah, so I wonder how, well, they obviously, God gave the instruction. They knew how to do things that we would not know how to do. But it's like, oh, that would have taken some ingenuity to craft all these things from that wood.
Yeah.
Well, verse 2, "You shall make its horns on its four corners. Its horns shall be of one piece with it. So the horns of the altar, they're part of the structure, and yet they're to blend, you might say, seamlessly with the altar. They're not to look like they're added on somehow. The entire altar is overlaid with bronze. Now, what do these horns represent? Has anyone studied these horns before? What's the significance of the horns of the altar? I didn't find that. I'm not saying that's not possible, but Carol? That's right. Exactly. That's one of the, they were used, that was number four on my list. And it's interesting, it's mentioned even before this. Exodus 21:14, but if a man acts with premeditation against his neighbor to kill him by treachery, you shall take him from my altar that he may die. So, Exodus 21, already the idea is the altar would be a place of protection. One commentator says this, the altar was a sanctuary, a miniature city of refuge. Isn't that interesting? The suppliant would grasp these horns in his hands, making himself a living sacrifice devoted to Yahweh and so under his protection. That is interesting. And I'll give three others. Some have suggested just as the animals had horns, so the altar also would have horns, a connection with the animals that would be offered up for sacrifice, at least some of them. Second, you find this at least in Psalm 118:27. See if you remember this verse. God is the light and he has given us light. Bind the sacrifice with cords to the horns of the altar. Isn't that interesting? Bind the sacrifice with cords to the horns of the altar. Now, why would you need to bind the sacrifice? I'm not entirely. I mean, is it going to go anywhere? I think maybe it's part of the picture of the binding and the dedication. Remember, Isaac was bound with ropes before. Well, yeah, that was yeah. So anyway, that's one verse. So the horns could serve as a place to help bind the animal. Third, the horns would allow for blood to be applied to the altar. Now, I suppose you could have put that blood on other parts, but you could say maybe it makes more sense that the blood would be placed on the horns of the altar. This is in Leviticus 4, verse 7. The priest shall put some of the blood on the horns of the altar of sweet incense before the Lord, which is in the tabernacle of meeting. And he shall pour the remaining blood of the bull at the base of the altar of the burnt offering, which is at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. So the priest shall put some of the blood on the horns of the altar. So you have at least four reasons. The horns of animals, places to bind the animal, for the putting of blood on the altar, and then these horns also then represented a place for the suppliant to hold, to seek mercy. Verse 3, there are five other special tools connected with the altar. You have pans for ashes. You have shovels to take something away, I suppose the ashes, other things. You have basins or tossing bowls used for the sprinkling of blood. You have forks or meat hooks. Remember, the priests could take a portion of the meat. Eli's sons are taking more than they were lawfully allowed to take. And then you have fire pans or coal scoops. So five special tools connected with the altar, and these are all made of bronze. Then verse 4. This is probably the most challenging aspect of the altar. You shall make a grate for it. Now, if that's all you had, you think, well, that's the top of the altar. It can't be solid bronze. There's got to be some sort of a, like when you have a barbecue, you have a grate. But that's not all that it's describing, because as we read this grate is verse 5, it's midway up the altar. And so one commentator says, this is the most obscure detail of the altar's structure and function, this grate. The New Legacy Standard Bible calls it the net, which is similar to a grate. And commentators have said it's kind of like a trellis, or it could even be a step or some sort of a collar. Now, the picture that I showed last week, the ESV Study Bible, shows that it's not talking about the top of the altar, but the sides of the altar. And some have suggested, well, in terms of airflow, it makes sense that it's not just solid. You have to bring in air from the bottom, and the thermodynamics would require that. So that's one aspect. We also see the bronze rings are connected with this, and that's why it can't just be talking about something at the top, because the bronze rings are connected with this grating, with this network. And it's at the midway up the altar. Now, others have suggested that what is described here is some sort of a step that went up to the altar. Or some have said, well, this grating is below the top of the altar. As I say, this is difficult. Kyle and Dalich, they say the bench rested upon it, or rather it hung from the outer edge of the bench and rested upon the ground like the inner chest, which it surrounded on all four sides and in which there were no perforations. It formed with the bench, or karkab. That was a word I never have heard before. It must come from another language. I tried to look it up and couldn't find anything. C-A-R-C-O-B. Karkab. That's your assignment. Find out what a karkab is. A projecting footing which caused the lower half of the altar to look broader than the upper on every side. Now, some have said, the altar is only 4.5 feet tall. Do you need to step up on something to do something on something that's only 4.5 feet tall? But if you, let's just turn to Leviticus 9:22. This is, I mean, Kyle and Dalich were not inspired, but they're not, I mean, they're thoughtful people, thoughtful Germans. Leviticus 9:22. Then Aaron lifted his hand toward the people, blessed them, and came down from offering the sin offering. Isn't that interesting? He's coming down. It seems to imply there's a step up. Right. A step down. So this is where some have suggested maybe part of the altar then was sort of a step. Now, maybe one reason is not because they're super short. Though, if you're on something that's 7.5 feet, maybe, so even though it's not very high, the fact that you have to reach out or do something, maybe that step helps, you know, serve the fact that you need to reach out more in a horizontal way. That's another thing to consider. It's not just the height, but the three dimensions. Correct, yes. So anyway, there is this coming down, which seems to imply, well, if he comes down, he had to go up. Verse 6, you shall make poles for the altar, poles of acacia wood overlaid with bronze. And we can understand why this altar was much smaller than the altar which Solomon constructed. That altar, Solomon's altar, was never meant to be moved. This altar would be moved many times. And just to reinforce this point, verse 8 clarifies the altar was not solid. Obviously, that would mean it was much easier to carry. I estimated acacia wood, some have suggested, has a density of about 0.6 of water. But if you had a solid piece of acacia wood and overlaid with bronze, even something that size, it would weigh 10,000 pounds or more. So it's hollow. It's still, I can imagine this still was not the easiest thing to carry, even being hollow. But when you overlay something with bronze, we're not given that detail, but it's certainly much more manageable and something that could be carried by, say, four strong men who were given that job of moving this special altar. Matthew Henry writes this: "This brazen altar was a type of Christ dying to make atonement for our sins. The wood had been consumed by the fire from heaven if it had not been secured by the brass, nor could the human nature of Christ have borne the wrath of God if it had not been supported by divine power." Well, we do reflect on how this does foreshadow Christ. There's a scholar of some note, Michael Heiser. I don't know if you've heard that name. His specialty is ancient Near East. And he was making a comment that the ancient Israelites, when they read Leviticus, would never have thought of Christ. And I think, well, what did Jesus say when Jesus said, "No, all of this points to me"? These things are to be interpreted as pointing to Christ. And I think we can say those who were given true faith did come to understand that they recognized, although this was not in vain, something more was still to come. So we can say this is a picture of Christ and the holy place, or the most holy place, that also where the blood of atonement is poured out. That also is what Christ has accomplished for us. One of the questions, I've reflected on this before, I don't have an answer, but how many sacrifices were offered every day, every month? When you read then Leviticus, the terms for offering sacrifice, every child, after the birth of every child, sacrifices were to be offered. So you think, boy, how many children were born in Israel every year? I mean, you recognize the tabernacle was a hive of activity, that the priests and the Levites, everyone doing their job. It's not, you know, we sometimes see a picture of just like one or two people in the tabernacle, but I think the idea is, no, it would have been a host of people. When the sacrificial system is up and running, it's going to be a very busy place. Mary, do you have a question?
No.
Okay. Any questions then on the altar?
You know, on that grate, I was just thinking, when we were talking about animals, when they have grates on farms, it's about cleaning, you know, sweeping things away.
Mm-hmm.
When you're envisioning a step, I thought, you know, we put grates on buildings, and the reason is to clean the shoe at entrance. So
yeah.
I don't know if it has anything to do with that possibly.
Well, it's on a surface. It's sitting on a horizontal or the top, so I don't think it has that function, other than the ashes would have to fall somewhere. Yeah, it's in the handout. Does show that if you have that, or from 2 weeks ago, one of the two. It shows kind of on the side a grating. If you look at the bronze altar, not that one, the previous weeks, yes. Mm-hmm. Next page. There, right there. Do you see the grating there at the bottom? That's what some have suggested. Yes, that's right. It's in the vertical. That's right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's on the top and the sides then. Mm-hmm. Well, let's look at verses 9 through 19. "You shall also make the court of the tabernacle. For the south side, there shall be hangings for the court made of fine woven linen, 100 cubits long for one side. And its 20 pillars and their 20 sockets shall be bronze. The hooks of the pillars and their bands shall be silver. Likewise, along the length of the north side there shall be hangings, 100 cubits long, with its 20 pillars and their 20 sockets of bronze, and the hooks of the pillars and their bands of silver. And along the width of the court on the west side shall be hangings of 50 cubits, with their 10 pillars and their 10 sockets. The width of the court on the east side shall be 50 cubits. The hangings on one side of the gate shall be 15 cubits, with their 3 pillars and their 3 sockets. And on the other side shall be hangings of 15 cubits, with their 3 pillars and their 3 sockets. For the gate of the court there shall be a screen 20 cubits long, woven of blue, purple, and scarlet thread, and fine woven linen made by a weaver. It shall have 4 pillars and 4 sockets. All the pillars around the court shall have bands of silver. Their hooks shall be of silver and their sockets of bronze. The length of the court shall be 100 cubits, the width 50 throughout, and the height 5 cubits, made of fine woven linen and its sockets of bronze. All the utensils of the tabernacle, for all its service, all its pegs, and all the pegs of the court shall be of bronze. So we again see we're moving now farther out. Now this is the courtyard of the tabernacle, the court of the tabernacle. So different degrees of holiness. The tabernacle opened to the east. We have a description then of the south side, the north side, the west side, and then we go to the east. And here we learn the dimension and the fencing for the court of the tabernacle. So we begin with the south side and learn it was made of fine woven linen. It's 100 cubits, or approximately 150 feet, about half the length of a football field. If you turn to Genesis 41, Genesis 41 and verse 42. This is where Joseph is taken out of prison. And we read, Pharaoh took his signet ring off his hand and put it on Joseph's hand. And he clothed him in garments of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck. This is in Scripture the first place where linen is mentioned, and one Hebrew lexicon says, in fact, the Hebrew word comes from Egyptian, which makes sense. This is a fabric, at least the fabric that the children of Israel are using. It's something they learned when they were in Egypt. So a fine fabric. Remember, linen is used for the inner tabernacle layer, and I think that's significant. The inner tabernacle layer, the courtyard, and the fine garments that Aaron and the priesthood would wear, they're all made from the same material. Isn't that interesting? Verse 9 also describes this linen as woven or twisted. And this word is only used in the book of Exodus. The word woven or twisted comes from a verb which has the idea of twisting something over and over again, bringing many threads together, I think is the idea of this woven or twisted linen. We have a reference here to a weaver, verse 16. And truly, this would have been amazing, painstaking craftsmanship. Think of how much material. I mean, we have the curtains in here. I suppose that's about 150 feet. So you think of, you have no machinery. How are you going to make that much fabric? It truly is amazing, Matt.
I use linen to paint on, and the best linen that you can get is made from Egyptian linen. When they're twisting it, there are different grades and stuff. You have to take the, you get really long pieces
Yeah.
And the longer the piece of flax, the better it is, because then you have less and less of those joints. So, but you have to, because it comes from a plant, and you strip the plant and make these long strands and you twist them together. And
yeah.
Little, sort of little bones.
Mm-hmm.
Where the two kind of open.
Yeah, makes sense.
And so you would have fine linen would be, you would be real meticulous about stripping those pieces of,
yeah.
Of flax, you know, all the way down, all the way down, make long, like the longest pieces you possibly
can. It's that, okay. So yeah, we kind of read this. Okay, we move on, and we realize, boy, the amount of labor. Remember, they do spend a year at Sinai. Part of that, I think, is the manufacturing of the tabernacle. Perhaps other reasons. So this fine linen. And then you have 20 pillars. The pillars then are spaced every 7.5 feet, approximately. The pillars are supported by sockets or bases. The bases are made from bronze. The fine linen at the top then is held by silver hooks and silver bands. So again, on the bottom bronze, you move upward and the material changes. Verse 11 tells us the north side is identical to the south side. Then we move to the west side of the court. The west side is 50 cubits, 75 feet in length. It's half the size of the south and north sides, and so half the number of pillars would be needed. Verse 13, now the east side. And that's also 50 cubits in length. Now, as an aside, the direction of the tabernacle opening is significant. The opening is on the east. When you go to the tabernacle, you're moving from the east to the west. When you're leaving, now you're going east. If you want to turn to Genesis 3:24, maybe you've noticed this before. Genesis 3, verse 24. Adam and Eve are driven out, and we have cherubim are placed at the east of the Garden of Eden. So the tabernacle opens to the east, and I think we can say that's a connection back to Eden. And sometimes, I don't think we can say every time, but sometimes going east is moving away from God's truth. At least in the case of Lot. Lot goes farther from Abraham and he goes to the east. And I think we can understand he's not doing that, with the right motive. He's seeing the lure of Sodom. Yes.
So this Mecca thing, you know how they have to face the serpent, do they face
the east? Well, they're facing, yes, I think, depending on where they are. I think it depends on where you are, right? In the world.
Moving away from God's truth, you said?
In some cases, it seems that when you are moving east, you're going away from God's truth. In some cases, yeah.
The guy mentioned once before here, this most interesting thing to me, because my brother-in-law is an electrical engineer in Iowa and oversaw the electricity for that Maharashi University in Fairfield, Iowa. And he's the one who pointed out to me not only all their buildings, they tore down the beautiful old New England-style buildings of Parsons College when they bought it, and they made these modern-looking, rather ugly buildings everywhere, all facing east.
Hmm.
But he said not only does the building have to face east, all their electricity, their water, their pipes, all have to come and go to the east.
That's interesting, yeah. Yeah.
So talk about going away from the Lord.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows where that started with that. They were
right.
An Hindu religion.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Maharashi University.
So they are... Did they say the reason for
Right. Yeah, right, yeah. 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 Well, right, yeah, that's Genesis 3:24. Yeah. So the east side of the tabernacle, now verses 14 and following, you have the entrance. And then on the east side, there are three parts. The north and south portion, 15 cubits in length, and then the gate, or the actual entrance to the tabernacle, is 20 cubits in length, 30 feet. And we observe the rest of the outside of the tabernacle, that fabric is just linen. That's all that's described. But now the entrance on the east side has blue, purple, scarlet thread, fine woven or twisted linen. And this matches the description of the special curtain inside the tabernacle, with one difference in terms of the inner curtain. The curtain separating the holy and the most holy place, not only does it have, let's turn to Exodus 26:31, verse 31. You shall make a veil woven of blue, purple, and scarlet thread, and fine woven linen. It shall be woven with an artistic design of cherubim. That inner curtain has the cherubim. Verse 36, then, you shall make a screen for the door of the tabernacle, woven of blue, purple, and scarlet thread, and fine woven linen made by a weaver. There are no cherubim on that curtain. And then also this outer then entrance, same material, but without the cherubim. Otherwise, those three curtains, I think we are to assume, look the same, which is interesting. Look again at verse 17. All the pillars around the court shall have bands of silver. Their hooks shall be of silver, and their sockets of bronze. One thing that's not specifically mentioned here, what material is used to construct these pillars or posts? And I don't believe we're explicitly told. Kyle and Dalich would say, well, acacia wood. And I suppose that would be the guess, but it's a detail not explicitly given to us. The base of each pillar is made of bronze. The top of each pillar then draped with a silver band, and then hooks used to hold the curtains were also made from silver. Verse 18 summarizes the size of this courtyard, 100 cubits by 50 cubits. This is approximately 11,250 square feet. It's about a lot size in Arlington Heights, we could say. It's not that large, quarter of an acre, approximately. Now notice also then, the tabernacle is twice the height of the courtyard curtains. Go back to Exodus 26. And verse 16, 10 cubits shall be the length of a board, and a cubit and a half shall be the width of each board. So the 10 cubits, 15 feet is the height of the inner tent, the tabernacle itself. The fencing on the outside, that's only 5 cubits in height, 7.5 feet. So you could easily see the tabernacle tent then from the outside. That's how it's designed. Now, instruction has already been given about the different utensils of the tabernacle. Anything connected with the holy place is made of gold. Then going back to verse 3, the utensils for the altar are made of bronze. Verse 19 says the pegs used to used to support the tabernacle, they're also made from bronze. Nothing is said about the cords. So you put in the tent pegs, somehow they're used to help anchor and support the entire structure. So we're not told what they used for that. I suppose they knew
this is what we use to hold up our tents. The word peg, we don't often think about that word, do we? At least I never did before. There's a beautiful use of this word in the book of Ezra. Now turn, if you would, to Ezra chapter 9. Ezra and then Nehemiah. Ezra 9. There has been a disaster as the children of Israel returned. They've married with the pagans. Exactly what they were not to do, but almost like what Israel did when she first entered the land. And here is a prayer of confession that is prayed. It starts in verse 6. And I said, "Oh my God, I am too ashamed and humiliated to lift up my face to you, my God, for our iniquities have risen higher than our heads and our guilt has grown up to the heavens. Since the days of our fathers to this day, we have been very guilty. And for our iniquities, we, our kings and our priests have been delivered into the hand of the kings of the lands, to the sword, to captivity, to plunder, and to humiliation, as it is this day." Then verse 8. "And now for a little while, grace has been shown from the Lord our God to leave us a remnant to escape and to give us a peg in his holy place, that our God may enlighten our eyes and give us a measure of revival in our bondage." I just thought that that was a precious use of that word. Zechariah 10:4, "From him comes the cornerstone, from him the tent peg, from him the battle bow, from him every ruler together." Zechariah 10:4. Well, finally, verses 20 and 21. Exodus 27, 20 and 21. "And you shall command the children of Israel that they bring you pure oil of pressed olives for the light to cause the lamp to burn continually. In the tabernacle of meeting, outside the veil, which is before the testimony, Aaron and his sons shall tend it from evening until morning before the Lord. It shall be a statute forever to their generations on behalf of the children of Israel." We might ask the question, why is this instruction given here, not given earlier when the lamp, the special lamp, is first described? Going back to Exodus 25 is where we have the gold lampstand. Why this instruction here? One reason may be this. This is a transition now. We have the tabernacle in structure. We're now moving to the tabernacle in action, we could say. The priests and their garments will next be described, and because the priests have a role in this, it may be why this command is given at this point. Notice that the oil is to come from an olive, and the way they get this oil is specified. It's to be beaten. Some versions read pressed. Other versions have beaten. One lexicon describes the word to mean pounded in like a mortar. Kyle and Dalep said, "Beaten, obtained not by crushing in oil presses, but by beating, when the oil which flows out by itself is of the finest quality and a white color." So it's not the olive press that would later be developed. You're going to get more from an olive press. But this is, I don't know if they would call this the extra virgin oil or what, but this is of a better level. And we observe here, verse 20, this is not the work of the priests. This is the work of the children of Israel. They are to bring this fine oil. And I think that that does have significance. John Calvin said, "This its purity then showed that nothing mean or common was signified by it, that the Israelites also might bring with them pure minds and duly prepared and disposed to consider the spiritual light." And we observe the lamps are specifically to burn from evening until morning, verse 21. The NET Bible says the lamps were to be removed in the morning, The wicks could be trimmed, the oil replenished, and then lit every evening to burn through the night. Luke 2, the prayer of Simeon. Lord, now you are letting your servant depart in peace according to your word. For my eyes have seen your salvation, which you have prepared before the face of all peoples, a light to bring revelation to the Gentiles and the glory of your people, Israel. In verse 21, I know we're running out of time here, the word tabernacle is actually the word tent. It's called the tent of meeting. And this is the first time this description is used. It's found 146 times in the Old Testament. The tent of meeting. Tabernacle is, I mean, it can mean tabernacle, but tabernacle is a different word, at least from Hebrew. 2 Chronicles 5:5. Then they brought up the ark, the tabernacle, or tent of meeting, and all the holy furnishings that were in the tabernacle, the priests and the Levites brought them up. Any final comments before we close? That was Luke 2:29-32.